there are a lot of pieces of 1L advice that get perpetuated year after year. And so you'll hear them from professors, from student services, from other law students and lawyers. These voices are really loud to do the same thing that we've always done, even though they don't work as well.
Hello and welcome to episode 454 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Ben Olson and with me is Nathan Fox. We're the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. Today we have Angela Vorpal. You're a 1L strategy coach who helps law students take control of their 1L grades. Super important. Anything else you want to add to that, Angela? You've been on the show before, twice actually. I interviewed you once and then you joined both of us. That was episode 378, I think, and 406. But yeah, what else should our listeners know about you?
Yeah, well, thank you guys so much for having me back a third time. I absolutely love these conversations, so I really appreciate it. Yeah, so I'm a 1L strategy coach. So I work with incoming 1Ls, so people who are starting law school, usually in the fall, to build out their 1L grade strategies ahead of time so that they can hit the ground running when classes start. Because usually what happens for most of us when we start 1L year is there's a lot of not knowing what we're supposed to do. And then we try to figure it out kind of on the fly as we're getting buried by the coursework. And so the idea is that we learn those strategies ahead of time, we get really familiar with them, really confident in them, and so we can actually just start implementing them when the work begins.
Awesome. Awesome. Very cool. We do want to jump into what you were talking about, and particularly these misconceptions people have about 1L year. But before we do that, I do want to tell our listeners about a free upcoming class that's going to be with Eric. It's a cross-training class. It's going to be one where he shows how to go from, if you're good at logic games, how can you translate that into being good at logical reasoning? That's going to be on May 21st at 5 p.m. Eastern. You can sign up for that at lsatdemon.com/free. Eric was just on the last episode and he was lamenting that these classes are probably going to be going away.
That's a super timely one, though. How to use your logic game skills to get better at logical reasoning, because that's what's happening. Starting in August, the logic games are gone and we'll have an additional section of logical reasoning. So I hope everybody will benefit from Eric's free class. When is that again and how do people sign up?
Yeah, that's May 21st at 5:30 p.m. Eastern. You can sign up at lsatdemon.com/free. Also, if you have questions or you want to share stuff with the web, with the podcast, you can go to thinkinglsat.com. That's what really drives this show. So Angela, let's jump to what you wanted to talk about today. And that is, you suggested talking about forgetting everything you've ever heard about 1L year. There are five pieces of old school law school advice that no longer work in this competitive 1L atmosphere, and you're going to tell us what to do instead.
Yeah, so I was really excited to have this particular conversation because there are a lot of pieces of 1L advice that get perpetuated year after year, mostly because we don't have the time and energy to sit down and think, how could we have done this differently or better or more powerfully? And so you'll hear them from professors, from student services, from other law students and lawyers. And so as a 1L strategy coach, what I was realizing was these voices are really loud to do the same thing that we've always done, even though they don't work as well. And so I wanted to talk through the five things that I have also shared with my students over the years for what to do differently and why. And so the first one has to do with the reading. So in law school, you are assigned a lot of reading. Everybody is usually aware of that, has heard of that. And the vast majority of what you're assigned to read are cases. So written judicial opinions that are designed to teach you aspects of the law. And the first thing that I will say, which feels very contrarian, but is also unfortunately or fortunately very true, is that reading every line of every case is actually the worst way that you can spend your time in law school. Now, the reason that this is A, hard to hear, is because your professors are going to be telling you to do nothing but this. reading cases is the only thing your professors are going to assign you to do in class. And so the reason that all of us feel the need to read these cases line by line, master them walking into class, is because our professors are telling us we need to. That's the expectation. But the reality is that the way that law school is graded is that your midterms, but more often than not, your final exams, those are going to be 100% of your grade. Your class participation, in effect, is 0% of your grade. And so what we wind up doing is spending 100% of our time on something that is 0% of our grade, which doesn't allow us to open up time on the back end to actually do the things that move the needle to the thing that is actually creating the grade for us. And so what winds up happening is that we get into the, and it's not our fault to be fair, we get into these class lectures where professors are cold calling, meaning calling on people at random with very specific, very detailed questions. And we feel like that means we need to know that information ahead of time and essentially have it memorized. And so that's the operating system that we employ. The reality is, as like sort of contradictory as this sounds, is it's not what's relevant about the cases that you're going to be assigned to read is not what you think is important. It's actually what your professor thinks is important, which sounds like that makes a lot of sense, but how we operate with that information really matters, because that means that anything that we're doing before a class, when we're reading a case, is guesswork, because professors have different takes on what they think is relevant from cases, even in the same law school, even section to section. And so what we don't want to do is pour all of our time and energy into trying to, again, master the material, A plus understand the material walking into class, when if we can just hold tight for a hot second, our professor is going to tell us every single thing they think is relevant from the case. That's what we get down on the page, and that's what we use on a final exam.
Angela, just to play devil's advocate here a little bit, even if we think, and it makes sense that the professor's view is the most important view, wouldn't reading beforehand and possibly every line put you in the best position to absorb that view and understand it, as opposed to having a blank slate, no context, and therefore less able to appreciate what the professor is saying about the case?
Yeah, really good question. So I'll sort of answer that in two parts. The first part is, as strong as I came out of the gate on not reading every line, that doesn't mean we don't look at the cases at all. And so what I always recommend for everybody, for every incoming 1L, is to look at a case resource first. The most popular one by far are the Quimby case brief videos, not even the Quimby case briefs, the Quimby case brief videos, because they basically break down an entire case into 3 to 8 minutes, explaining it as if they were explaining it to an eighth grader in sort of this animation context that actually makes it understandable. Because to your question about, or let me back it up, because what we do want is to be able to follow the class lecture. And the way that I kind of present this as a mindset for incoming 1Ls is we want to understand it at a D plus level, which is very different than understanding it at an A plus level. So at a D plus level, we're able to follow the lecture, we're able to take notes on it, we're able to, at a very, very high level, understand the concept, but again, not at a level of mastery. The other thing to keep in mind too, when we're talking about reading the cases, is that we assume that if we read a case line by line, that is going to translate into understanding it better. When in fact, more often than not, it has more of a harmful effect than it does a helpful effect. Because when we look at cases, the judicial opinions that are written for these things that were assigned are not designed with law students in mind. Judges are not sitting around thinking about how can I identify the issue very clearly, identify the rule very clearly, identify my holding very clearly, identifying the reasons why I came to that holding very clearly. And so what winds up happening is we read these cases and we're essentially scavenger hunting for what the rule of law is that this case is supposed to stand for, what this case is supposed to be teaching us. And so in doing that, we get incredibly, incredibly deep in the weeds and actually lose the thread on what in the world this case stands for and why it's being taught in the first place. And so my very, very strongly preferred approach is for you guys to get a 30,000 foot view of what this case stands for, what the rule of law is it's supposed to be teaching us. Then we have a GPS for if we were to decide to read a case at all, we now know what we're looking for. And that actually makes it that so much easier to internalize that information than if we just crack open a case book, blank, start on line one and move all the way down.
Interesting. I mean, as you're talking, I'm thinking about cases themselves, and they are really microscopic, right? When you look at the whole case law or the precedent and what role it plays in that that thread that you were talking about. But you're saying that when you read line by line, you're going into the very details of something that's already fairly detailed, right? It's just one case in a whole thought of how the law should evolve.
Yes. And actually, even worse than that, because I've thought about, all right, how is law school taught? How could it be taught better? Because I have a lot of criticisms of the system. And one of the things that winds up happening is we're assigned these cases and they stand for rules of law. That is why we're learning them. Rather than the idea behind case-based teaching is rather than have us just read a textbook where it just lays out all the rules of law and why we have them, the way that law school has been taught for 140 years is that we are going to learn these rules of law through reading these judicial opinions that were designed to resolve disputes in litigation. When we do that, it makes it infinitely more difficult to figure out what the quote unquote point of the case is. And so what really should happen, in my opinion, is the lecture should happen first. So you have a hired professional, expert, professor who is teaching you what the rule of law is and why we have it. And then we're assigned to read the case, which is essentially a historical historical context for how this rule of law came to be. But it's very, very difficult and much more confusing than clarifying to do it in reverse, which is how we do it in law school now, which is, hey, everybody, read this entirely complex, very convoluted opinion that is hiding all of the nuggets of wisdom that we're trying to extract. And then in class, after a lot of very stressful, anxiety-inducing questions, then I'll tell you what the rules of law are. And so it should be in reverse. And because it's not, we have to uncomfortably force ourselves to do it in reverse.
You're reading the judge writing contemporaneously. I mean, in the past, they're like, the case hasn't come out yet. This is the decision of the case. You don't know what the impact is. You know what the impact is on those litigants, maybe, but you don't know what the impact is next month or next year or 10 years from now or whatever. So when you're reading them like describing the law at that point, but it's 1972.
Yes.
Who knows
exactly
what it actually means?
Exactly. You have no, because you have no frame of reference. So you don't know if did this become the majority approach? Did this become the minority approach?
Right.
Is this an approach from the 70s? Did we advance from that? Where does this fit into the overall structure of the course?
Well, half the time, especially in, I mean, I just remember like 1L, you're reading Blackstone and you're reading shit from the decisions from 1820 or whatever. And it's like, well, of course, none of this is the law today, but they think that you're going to learn how the law has evolved by giving these this grand. And it's like, yeah, but you don't even know what the law is. If you don't know what the law is, then why do you give a shit what it was, what it was, but isn't anymore, but we still don't know what the law is today. It's just so crazy.
100%. They basically, so many professors talk about the law basically in a patchwork quilt situation where they're just presenting sort of these pockets of information and it's your job to reverse engineer what exactly is happening in what order and why.
So I'm buying this advice that you should probably not carefully read every line, you know, like, especially think about like reading dissents and stuff. Like, okay, so that never was the law. And now, but now you're reading it and it's going to like infect your understanding of the case. It's like reading wrong answer choices, Ben, on reading comprehension, right? Like on the LSAT, you're like reading these wrong answer choices and it's like getting into your head that like, oh, well, that's what it said in the passage. No, that ain't what it said in the passage. And the dissent is not what it said in the decision of that case. Okay, so I'm buying all that we can probably skim our 1L reading and then maybe go back and reread it after lecture. I want to push back on one thing that you said, Angela. You said class participation is essentially zero. But if a professor is willing to bump your grade from a B+ to an A- or from an A- to an A, isn't that actually like a huge impact on your grades?
Yeah. So I hear this a lot where the professor says your class participation is technically 3% or 5%, or I reserve the right to bump you up or bump you down.
Yep.
And so here's my take on this. So the amount of work that you would have to put in pre-class to show up to class, mastering the material, A+, volunteering every day in order for the professor to notice you enough to potentially, hypothetically, consider bumping you up half a letter grade can be so much more powerfully spent in post-class work, which means everything that's happening after class. Because what tends to happen is 1Ls is that we do maybe 99% of our time is pre-class because we're scared of cold, makes total sense, right? We're scared of cold calls. We want to impress the professor. The professor is telling us we need to. And then we leave zero to, I know I'm exaggerating, but 1-10% on outlines, canned answers, and practice problems. And that's actually where you're internalizing the material, you're practicing applying it, and that's how your grade doesn't go from half a letter grade. It goes 3-letter grades higher than it otherwise would have been.
I buy all that too. I just don't think class participation is actually zero. What I think is there's other ways to get that class participation. The professor doesn't expect you to know everything. The professor just expects you to participate. So like if you sit up front with a smile on your face and you obviously pay attention, if you ask questions, you know, you don't have to know it. Like the guy who always has his hand in the air because he thinks he knows everything so that he can then like lecture the class. I don't know that that guy's getting the bump anyway. I think the person who's getting the bump is the one that's there with like, you know, they're like participating in the community. They don't miss classes. They're not a pain in the ass to the professor. They smile, they're friendly, everybody knows them. Like, that's getting the grade bump, right?
I have to agree with that. Sorry, Angela, I was just thinking about, like, also little things, like, before class, you know, just not overboard.
Going to professor's office hours.
Once in a while. Again, not overboard, right? But hi, looking forward. That was a really interesting lecture today. That's it. That's enough. You don't need to go further. But, like, the professor feels good about you, thinks you're earnest.
Like, contrast that with the guy who actually knows everything, but he's like kind of shy, sits in the back. When he gets cold called once in the entire semester, when he gets cold called, he nails it. But then he never asks a question, never volunteers, never smiles. Nobody knows. Like, the professor doesn't even know that dude's name. How are you going to get a grade bump if the professor doesn't know your name?
Well, totally. And here's the other thing that we haven't touched on yet. But when we're talking about pre-class work, like getting a D+ understanding, a baseline so that you can follow the class lecture and so you can fumble through cold calls, right? Our goal is not mastery. Our goal is not nailing it. But there are absolutely ways to more strategically participate, which is what you guys are talking about, which is, for example, if your professor takes volunteers, you don't have to master every case. You pick one every 6 weeks and then you go nuts on it. So that you are drawing attention to yourself in a good way. Or of course, if your professor tells you ahead of time that you're going to be on call, you nail those. So mastery of those specific cases, but not day in and day out, every single case in every single class, because you're sacrificing too much really, really precious time on the back end. But yeah, there are strategic ways to place yourself in those situations. And absolutely, like office hours, which like it kind of overlaps in a lot of different strategic areas, is another way to show the professor you're doing the work, to bring practice problems, to show them that you're keeping up with your outlines. Like, that's going to be really impressive to them. And there's going to be a personal element there.
I just think the personal part can't be understated. I mean, as a teacher, right? Like, to offer my perspective as a teacher, I way prefer people asking questions to people who want to explain it to the class. So nobody thinks you're an expert in this except for you. And we've, you know, those of us who have gone through 1L have seen this just every single day where some dumbass 1L thinks they know everything and they want to keep participating. And maybe they're just trying to get the grade bump or whatever. But I can't imagine that the professor actually appreciates you spouting off your 1L half-assed knowledge when instead you could just be there going like, yeah, you know, I don't actually know. Or like, can I ask a question about XYZ? Like, asking a good question that moves the discussion forward seems so much more helpful than just like spouting off whatever limited knowledge you might have.
Yeah. And I think of it too, because coming from somebody who never raised her hand in any class ever, no volunteering, no asking of questions, nothing. I was like, I am too intimidated by this. So I'm just going to put my head down, do the work, get the grade on the final exam and move forward with my life. The way that I like to think about the reading is more in terms of an ROI, a return on investment. And so the pre-class work is going to be the lowest ROI activity that you can do in the studying process for law school. So it doesn't mean it's zero. There's 0% value there, but it's so low for the amount of time you would have to invest in order to show up to class with this A-plus level of understanding for a hypothetical potential grade bump, maybe. I would much rather invest that time and energy on the back end where there is no hypothetical grade bump, maybe. It's I'm going after the highest grade in the class.
Awesome.
Excellent. Yeah.
Okay. Number you guys two? Want to move on to the second
yeah, yeah.
one?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We're okay, ready. Great. Yep. So being more aggressive and contrarian and sort of following in that trajectory, the second thing I would say, which I know is going to cause a lot of enemies, is taking class notes by hand is not a viable strategy in law school when every word matters. So there is a very famous study out there that says that handwriting your notes creates a deeper understanding of the material than typing your notes in a transcript style form. And I have no reason to doubt that that is probably true. The problem with that study is that they tested the participants 30 minutes after and then a week after. And in law school, a couple of things are different from if anybody has heard of or read about that study. In law school, one, the information is coming at you at bullet speed. So we're getting a massive amount of content constantly, all day, every day, every week until final exams. And the other thing is we're not being graded on this material until all the way at the end of the semester. So not a week from now, not 6 weeks from now, in some cases, 2, 3, 4 months from now, right? The other thing that's different about the law, about learning the law, is that the literal words of the law matter. And so it's not enough to just summarize them or paraphrase them. Like these words are called terms of art. They have legal significance to them. And then the third thing that's different about law school than likely any undergrad or graduate class is that the way your professor structures the language is also really important. Because as contradictory as it seems, we have a patchwork quilt sort of system of laws in this country. We have a common law system. So we're learning laws from cases. We're learning laws from statutes. We're learning laws from restatements. And so how your professor decides to pick and choose the language that he or she is using is what they want to see on a final exam. They don't want to see it another way. They don't want to see it in another order. And so being able to get those words on the page as verbatim as possible is going to be really, really powerful because then we can get them into our outlines, into our canned answers, and then ultimately into our final exam answers.
Angela, I want to clarify something. So when you say typing, I hear you saying, hey, you're going to have strings of words, phrases, sentences that you want to match exactly to what the professor is saying. So you need to type them out because you're not going to be able to write them down quickly enough by hand. But are you also saying that we then have to just flood our computer with notes? Or is there a more judicial way of or civilized way of saying, hey, you know what? Okay, I need to note that, but I don't need to note all that. Are you just madly typing in class? Because that sounds extraordinarily painful. And I'm so glad I'm not in law school anymore.
Oh my gosh. So I'm going to give you the answer that you're going to hate. And the answer is yes, the latter. I am a huge, huge, huge proponent of transcript style type notes. The thing that all of your professors will tell you not to do. The thing that everybody tells you doesn't relate to understanding. And the reason is, from what we talked about, we need to get the information on the page so we can use it later. If that information is not on the page, there's no freaking way that we're going to remember it in 2 months, 3 months, 4 months down the road. And the other thing to remember too is that anything coming out of your professor's mouth is relevant for the final exam, meaning we can use it. And this is real nuts to say, but I'm talking about hypotheticals the professor proposes. I'm talking about personal anecdotes, professor opinions, policy references, all of that stuff is, and I don't want to, and I think an important thing here is not to talk about it as important or not important, because that gets us in trouble. It's relevant in that it is usable. We can use it to craft an argument on a final exam, which is ultimately what all of this information is being used for. And so what tends to happen, Yeah.
Oh, that sings to the professor, right? That basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. That reiterates things that they talked about in class. And so what tends to happen, especially with new 1Ls, is that we have been taught that we should somehow magically have this filter where we can decide what is important and what is not important from someone who just started as a 1L, who just started yeah. learning this information from scratch. And yeah. everybody says, yeah, just write down what's important. Right. There's no way we have that filter in place yet. And B, I would argue that even as a 2L and 3L, I would take transcript style class notes because I'm writing down things that my classmates are not writing down. And I can use that stuff on a yeah. final exam and it's going to be lost on them.
I'm reminded of, again, you know, to go back to the LSAT, I'm reminded of people who underline a lot when they do their reading comprehension. And it's like, I look over their shoulder and I go, well, back in the old, you know, classroom days, I would look over their shoulder and I'd go, oh, so I see you highlighted. Well, I'm highlighting the important part. I'm highlighting the main point. And I look at what they highlighted and I'm like, yeah, but what? That's like a random sentence. That's not any main point. You don't know what's important. You have no idea what's important. That's a good point.
Exactly. And again, like, this is the same when we talk about cases, and this is how we get in trouble with like these massive case briefs is it's the mindset and the distinction that's so helpful that I found is not what's important and what's not. It's let's get it on the page from our professor, and then we can use it. If it is usable, we can get points for it. And I think that's the most important thing to keep in mind, because I'll have students up until 2-3 days before a final exam who are telling me they are re-listening to class lectures because they didn't realize or what they thought was fluff wound up being something that the professor cared about. And so instead of putting yourself in that position where you're randomly guessing, get it on the page. We can use it. And there's nothing else you're doing in class anyway. I mean, you have that hour and a half to 2 hours. You're kind of locked into that space. Go ahead and get that content down on the page. And then we can talk more about what to do with it afterwards.
If nothing else, it'll give you something to do in class and keep you
to keep you occupied. Yeah.
My other suggestion was going to be, what about like getting a voice to text type of a thing, or getting an actual recording of the class and then having it transcribed?
Or just go further, right? What about AI? Like, if Nate was going to put a gun to my head and said, go back to 1L, I'd, you know, okay, I would pull out AI and have it transcribe the meeting and tell me, you know,
yeah, that's what I was thinking. Some sort of just an app running on your phone or running on your computer that's just going to transcribe everything for you.
No.
Yeah. So I've actually had those conversations with my students of if you have a professor who allows you to record the lecture, and some of them do, and some of them will allow real time notes to be taken. You obviously have to check with them, but that's definitely worth testing. The reason that I would want to test it and see how it's working is obviously the audio quality, obviously the transcription quality. But also when you're typing, you have more control over the material about where you put it. So one of the things we talk about when we're taking class notes is this concept of integration, meaning that as the professor is talking through the lecture, we're ideally not just taking notes in sort of a narrative ongoing format. We're actually strategically placing the notes in between the sections of our case briefs that we have already taken. So that would be the only thing to be aware of if you're going to test it is, does that lack of quality and or lack of control, is that still more valuable to you than taking typed notes on your own? That would be the thing to test. But I, kind of as an old school approach, I like the element of control because the other thing I'm able to do is emphasize things where I can like underline, bold, highlight, professor opinion, like add context to it in a way that pure transcription wouldn't be able to do.
Well, and there's also going to be so much garbage, like 50% garbage in the AI transcription. I mean, anytime I've seen a transcript of a meeting or whatever, that shit's not useful for me when I go back to it, because there's so much ums and ahs and, oh, well, let's take 5 minutes. And, oh, you know, like the professor calling on somebody, you obviously don't need anything that anybody else in the class says.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
I can see that not working.
Given where the technology is now, though, it seems like an ideal solution would be to take notes like you're suggesting, Angela, but have this recording and then do things like take your notes and say, hey, is there anything that I missed? Because right, AI can boss it around and it can point out things and you say, oh yeah, that's a good point. I didn't get that line. You get that in there, but you're still fundamentally relying on the notes that you're taking.
Yes. And so I do get that question a lot of, if I have the class recording, should I go back and listen to it? So the default approach is ideally no, we're not going back and listening to the class recording, because what that is now doing is duplicating the amount of time that we have allocated to this particular study step. And so if we can get all the class notes down in that hour and a half, 2 hour time period, well enough to be able to understand them and read them later, that's great. We have successfully solidified that time period for that step. If you do not catch something in the class lecture and you know you don't, what I would recommend doing is either A, asking the professor or somebody next to you immediately after class, or B, timestamping it at 11:58 a.m. I did not catch, like, ? That way, if you do decide to go back to the class recording, you're doing it very intentionally and very strategically, instead of going back and listening to a full 2.5 hour lecture or reading a transcript of 2.5 hours, because again, that's going to add on additional time that we could then be spent using to move on to the other study steps.
Well, and speaking of class participation, that's a perfect opportunity. You're there doing the best you can, and then there's something you didn't catch. Raise your damn hand. Like, the professor is probably desperate for any kind of participation. Like, half the class is shopping for shoes, watching UFC fights, instant messaging, you know, like a third of them aren't even there. And you're right there, like, actually typing. And then when you raise your hand and say, I'm sorry, I missed something. You said something about XYZ. The professor loves you. Like, that's your grade bump, because they now know who you are. Oh, yeah, I remember him. He was there actually doing shit every class.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also, if nothing else, it gives you a pause in your typing to have him or her repeat something important. And if you didn't catch it, I guarantee you the majority of the class also did not catch it.
So, Angela, that totally makes sense. And there's no way I could have the willpower to go back and re-listen to 2.5 hours of what was already miserable, right? But what I'm thinking is that this thing is recording, turning it into a transcript, you're copying and pasting that transcript into ChatGPT or whatever, and you're saying, here are my notes, here are these notes, is there anything that I missed? Because
so I guess the pushback that I have against that is, the first thought is, we would love to be able to get to a place where we can take class notes that we trust. Right. So ideally, if we're taking the notes, we know what we're writing, we know where we're putting them. That's the ideal scenario. If we're sort of starting the semester and we don't 100% trust ourselves, yes, of course, you could go back to the class recording. You could go back to the class transcript. You could control F a word or a point in the transcript where you felt lost. And for sure, you could, like, copy paste plus it is what I call, like, put it back in your class notes. That's totally fine. Again, we want to limit that as much as possible so that we can move on to the other steps. But as you're getting comfortable with the note-taking process, for sure, that's sort of a crutch that you can use. The thing with ChatGPT, the reason I wouldn't do that is, again, because I don't want a summary of what my professor said. I want the literal words that he or she said. And so ChatGPT is likely going to lose some of those terms of art, that significance, the order. All of that stuff is vitally important to how our professor wants us to present the information on the exam.
Cool. Okay. Number three.
Okay. So all of these I feel strongly about, but this is what I feel strongly about as well. And it's that supplements are not a shortcut, cheating, or being lazy. They are a vitally important part of the learning process. So as you guys start law school, you'll hear this term supplement thrown around a lot, and it has a horribly negative connotation. And what a supplement is, sort of a generic word for any law school resource that is not your professor and not your textbook. And so historically, supplements take the form of what they call hornbooks, which are basically sort of breakdowns of the content of your courses in very easy to understand, very linear, methodical terms. They can also be videos. So there are certain resources out there. Quimby is one of them. Studicata is one of them. Barbary is one of them, that present the information in a video. And then you also have 2L and 3L outlines. So for purposes of this conversation, anything that is not your professor or not your textbook, we're considering a supplement, meaning an additional resource to help you understand the content. And what you will hear inevitably from your professors, from student services, is that supplements are cheating, they're being lazy, they're shortcuts, they're impeding your ability to learn. And in my opinion, nothing could be further from the truth. So if a professor were to actually teach course content in a clear, linear, methodical way, he or she would teach it very similarly to how a supplement lays it out. But the way that law school professors love to teach is actually much more hodgepodge quilt work, meaning the way that they present the class lecture most of the time is going to be through hypotheticals, rhetorical questions, and in content sort of in these vacuums, rather than presenting you with a very clear, very straightforward structure of the course. Here is where we are. Here is why we're here. Here's what the rule of law is. Here's why we do it. Here are the exceptions. Here are why those matter. And so supplements allow you to supplement your understanding from the class lecture with these pockets of content that your professor most of the time, I was going to say intentionally or unintentionally, but most of the time intentionally is not presenting to you. And even if a professor is being incredibly linear and clear and straightforward, meaning some professors will have PowerPoint slides where they are walking you through the content step by step, it is still incredibly valuable to have a supplement because you basically have a sounding board of making sure that you are understanding the content, having it said to you in a different way that allows it to be internalized even more deeply than if you just heard it once from your professor.
I was thinking about these professors. They're people who went to law school, played that law school game and won, right? And so they're just like, hey, this is the best way to do it. This is how I got straight A's and you can figure it out. So intentional or unintentional, right? It's probably...
Well, and it's funny because professors run a gamut, right? And there's sort of this continuum between the professor who absolutely, these professors still exist, where they will come out and say to your face, it is not my job to teach you the law. It is your job to teach yourself the law. And it's my job to make you think or something like that. And these professors, they have black letter law on their exams. They are expecting you to make the arguments just like state the rules, make the arguments just like every other professor. But they will very clearly articulate that it is not their job to teach you the law, all the way to the other end of the spectrum where you have the professor who gives you their outline or gives you their PowerPoints and all they do is read from them, like line by line, subsection by subsection, and then you have everything in between. Hmm. And so, of course, with the professors who are intentionally sort of hiding the ball, as you'll hear it said, we have to teach ourselves the law. But even the professors that are reading from an outline, it's still so, so, so helpful to hear that information from another source, again, so that you can make sure that it's clicking for you, if that languaging it in another way is still making sense to you, and basically almost like cross-referencing another source to make sure that you don't have any gaps in knowledge or misunderstandings.
Ben, did you use supplements in law school?
100%. Yeah.
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 Do you remember which ones?
I remember the pictures on the front of them. It was like a soft back book and they were all tan. They all looked the same except for they had like slightly different colors depending on whatever law they were on. But yeah.
Angela?
Well, so it's interesting too, because a lot of people will hear the term supplement. They're like, great, I'm on board. I want this content taught to me in a way that actually makes sense, that I can actually understand. But what makes it tricky is knowing where in your study process to layer that in, because you're already underwater with the cases and you're going to class and you're trying to create outlines. So what I will say for the supplements is if we're talking about supplements kind of as a generic term, my favorite supplement for anyone to use is going to be a 2L or 3L outline from a person who had that same class with that same professor and got a B plus or higher in the class. Because that is going to be the closest mirror, most closely your professor in the way that he or she teaches. So that's going to be the most beneficial supplement you can use. If you don't have that or you can't find one, then the next layer down would be usually either a traditional hornbook or a video that is teaching you sort of the content at a 30,000 foot view, meaning here are the rules of law so that you have an understanding of, again, what that GPS is and then how your professor is structuring it. So that can usually happen during the outlining stage. So after reading, after going to class, the next step is creating your outline. And so you can layer that in either to use as a base, if we're talking about a 2L, 3L outline, or if we're talking about a video or a horn book as a double check against these concepts, especially the ones that you're having trouble with, especially the ones that are more confusing for you.
Angela, all this talk it's given me this low grade anxiety about just how crazy law school is. Like, law school has been around for hundreds of years and they haven't figured out how to just let me convey Civ Pro to you as clearly and as quickly and as efficiently as possible. It's still just like you have all these third parties coming in. You exist. Let's help you navigate this maze.
But the professors aren't educators.
They aren't. They aren't, right? They're just...
they have no training in education. Students. They're not specialists in education. They're legal scholars. They're legal researchers. They teach one class every other semester.
Yes. And here's the other thing. This is sort of my cynical side coming out. So there's many things wrong with the way that law school is taught, in my opinion. But one of them is they're not actually, this sounds terrible to say, but it's true. Your professors actually aren't incentivized to teach the information clearly, because the more clearly they teach the information, the tighter that curve is on the final exam and the harder it is to distinguish between grades.
Yeah, they give they get 100 homogenous exams, then what do they
exactly
what do they do? So they have to teach it in this like obfuscating, weird, all disjointed manner. And then when the one person like gives it back to them the way that looks more like their outline, they're like, oh, that's an A. Yeah, you get it.
Yeah. And again, that's not to say that professors are bad people or that they don't try to be straightforward sometimes. They're just not incentivized to do that. And so it's actually
they're
in their best interest.
Right? They're
disincentivized
discouraged
to do it.
If they did a killer job and everybody got a B+ or higher because it just made sense, then they would say, oh, you're inflating grades.
Yeah. And they can't, like, depending on the law school, they actually can't award more than X number of A's or B's or more than a higher GPA.
Yeah, that's how
overall
it was in my school. It was like, no, there's going to be 15% A's and that's it. It was like 15% A's and 75% B's and then 10% C's and lower. That was it.
Exactly. Exactly. And the other part too, so that's kind of the cynical but realistic reality of law school. But the other part too is that I understand why they wanted to teach us the law in the form of cases and instead of just here are some PDF printouts of all the rules of law ever.
Sure, sure.
And I understand why they want us to have classroom discussions in the Socratic method where they're asking us questions about the cases and why the professor or why the judge came to the conclusion they did. I totally understand that. The problem is that is beautiful and wonderful and lovely. But the amount of content that law school covers is so massive and so non-conducive to learning that we don't have the luxury of time of doing what they want us to do and also doing what we have to do. And so when we're faced with that inevitable decision day to day, if you're sort of a strategically minded individual, you're going to do the things that get you the results you want to get. Because at the end of the day, going through a class in law school, the ROI, the sort of value proposition of a class is the grade that you get so that you can then use that to go get the job you want to get and go build the life you want to get and the career that you want to build. And so if that's, I know how cynical that sounds, but we don't have both the time to do things in sort of the utopian way and the realistic, all the things we actually have to get through before the end of the semester way.
So bottom line is to use a supplement that is as close to the professor in class that you're taking.
Yeah.
Yes, I'll give you that would be amazing.
Brief anecdote on that. I had a very old man professor who taught legal ethics, had written the book on legal ethics, and had written the horn book on legal ethics. I went to the first day of class and I realized that he was going to sit in the front of the class every day and just not look up and just read out of his notes. So that was the only class I ever went to. I was a terrible student. That was the only class I ever went to from him, was the first day of class. And then I went to the final exam. It was open book, open notes, open everything. I didn't read anything in the class. The entire semester, I read nothing. I had his horn book and I had his outline from the class. I took a box cutter and I cut out the pages from the horn book because the horn book was too much. I cut out the pages from the 80 page. I had gotten the horn book for $3 on Amazon used. I cut out the pages that correlated to the stuff that was on the actual outline for the class. So I just walked in there with, I had them stapled together, like 19 pages from the horn book that I had read once, got an A on the exam. That was it. I mean, and I did nothing else besides that. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Extreme example, obviously, but you know, to your point of supplements are important. And especially if you can get a supplement from that actual professor, well, they're telling it to you in the simplest possible way that they understand it. So then if you feed that back to them on the exam, oh, wow, you really get it.
Yes. And I've actually had students who will get an actual outline from the professor, like their actual outline, their actual notes, and then they won't look at it all semester until the end. And it's, I understand why that thought process is happening. The thing that they will say to me is, oh, I didn't know it could be that easy, or that felt too easy. And so I think the thought process, because I had it too when I was a 1L, is, oh, we're supposed to organically learn this stuff from zero without looking at other outlines, without looking at other supplements, just reverse engineer it as best we can from the reading. And that's going to make us understand it better. And the reason we think that is because that's how our professors are telling us that the learning process happens. That is the most ineffective, convoluted way to learn the law, which if we had 17 years to do this, sure, we could reverse engineer the cases, I suppose. But even then, we still wouldn't understand it as well as if we went from the shortest line from point A to point B, teach ourselves the law. And then the way that you learn to think like a lawyer, which is what the value proposition of law school ostensibly is that once you learn the law, then you can take that law, apply it to facts and analyze it. That's actually thinking like a lawyer, but we can't do that step until we know what the law is. And so the fastest way to get there is what's coming out of your professor's mouth. And if we have a resource that is as close to what your professor is saying as possible.
Number four.
This is going to create a lot of enemies as well. But number four, outlining is not enough. So a lot of people in law school, the way I think about it is I call it the five-step study plan. So when you're talking about internalizing the content, learning the content of law school and using it, practicing it, it goes reading notes, class notes, outlines, canned answers, practice exams. And so we all hear case briefs, which is what I call reading notes. A lot of people skip the class notes step, believe it or not. And then a lot of us hear outlines. And so most of us as 1Ls spend all of our time creating outlines, which the outlining process is very important. That's where we are organizing the information. I call it repetition and organization, showing our brains it again, but then organizing it in a way that makes sense to us, that is prioritizing the rules and then sub-prioritizing the cases. But that in and of itself is not enough. The way that I see students who do the best, who perform the best on final exams, is they do one more repetition and organization step, meaning they have their full outline and then they do it again. And you probably are going to hear a lot of different terms for this. You might hear attack outline, you might hear short sheet, you might hear pre-write, you might hear rule statements. I call them canned answers. And what that means is once you have shown your brain the information and organized it, we want to do that one more time before we walk into the final exam room, because that's actually what it means to study, to internalize the material. And so we want to, when we look at it, not just reread our outline, which is what a lot of people will do, but we want to touch it. We want to create something with it. And in that creation process, that's how we make sure that we actually understand it and put it in a usable format that we can use on a final exam.
And when you say canned answers, I mean, there's a lot of times where they'll end up asking you questions that are, if not exactly something that you've already answered on your notes or outline or whatever you want to call it, but stuff that's similar enough. You're not going to probably use all of the stuff you wrote, but there's enough of the stuff on there that you're like, oh, all I have to do is just transcribe this exactly. I've already answered this final exam question before I even walk into the room.
Oh, yeah. And that's the whole idea, is that there is a lot of work that we can front load before we walk into the final exam room. And we want to front load all of it so that once we walk into that room, we get the final exam, we look down. The only thing our brain has to think about is these new facts that we've never seen before and how we're going to apply them to those rule statements. And so beforehand, you can write out the issue, you can write out the rule statements, you can write out what I call situation specific rules, you can write out the policy, you can literally write out everything and even more importantly, structure it in a way that sort of looks like an a la carte menu so that when you get on the final exam, what you have to then do is just pick and choose the rule statements or the policy arguments that you're going to use. So when we talk about canned answers, there's seven parts to them, but the two most important pieces to keep in mind are going to be the rule statements, so the rules of law called black letter law, and then the analysis attack plan. And so the analysis attack plan is the order in which we are going to analyze each piece of a legal rule. And so for some legal rules, that's very basic, meaning just the elements of the legal rule. So for negligence, it would be duty, breach, causation, damages. For other legal concepts, it's much more complex than that. So if you're talking about personal jurisdiction or diversity jurisdiction, there's going to be about seven steps in there, all of which we need to analyze in order to get to our conclusion. And so those two things are the most important, but all of that stuff can be front loaded. The only thing we can't know heading into the exam is going to be the fact pattern.
So rereading is not effective, right? Because it's so easy and that's what everybody wants to do.
The thing about rereading is, and I'm definitely not a neurological expert in any way, shape, or form, but it's very, very passive. If you ever try to, for example, read somebody else's outline or even reread your own, it's very easy to gloss over it and just assume you kind of sort of a little bit get it, understand it. If you have to recreate that document, meaning put it in words that make sense to you, in a structure that makes sense to you, that is a totally different level of understanding. And you can actually identify the pieces that you do not understand that you then have to ask the professor. Otherwise, we kind of have this C+ or maybe B+ at best sort of general understanding of this, but we're never going to go all the way down the rabbit hole and be able to master this stuff if we're not the ones creating it.
Yeah, the research backs that up 100%, Angela. Rereading feels good because it's easy and now it's in your mind again, but because it doesn't require any effort, you don't have to pull it out or deal with it. Like you're saying, it doesn't stick.
There's a tie in here to the LSAT. I was just complaining in class yesterday about wrong answer journals that people like to keep. They like to like write down, okay, I missed this question. Here's what I didn't understand about the question. Here's why I missed it or whatever. Or like, here's why the right answer is right. And then they think that they're going to go back and like reread that. And then that's going to somehow teach them something. And I'm always like, I think you're just writing that down as an excuse for not actually understanding it. You're writing down something about the question. But if you really got it, if you really like just paid attention to it enough right now to review it and figure out what's going on, then you would understand it and you wouldn't need to have this lengthy, you know, like, really, you've got a 50-page wrong answer journal of all of the questions that you've missed and all of the important takeaways. But rereading that isn't gonna, I don't know, it's just not the same as actually understanding it in the first place.
Yeah. And I think part of the, if not all of the confusion comes from this concept of studying in law school, which is like this very nebulous concept that doesn't really mean anything. And we don't know what it means. So we don't know tactically, logistically, what we're supposed to be doing. And so we, from undergrad or grad school, will kind of borrow some of those tendencies. And that looks like, again, reading somebody's outline or reading a supplement or reading a model answer from a professor. And that's all fine and good. That's kind of the lowest level of effort, unfortunately, that we could do. But we don't want to just read that stuff. We want to take it, copy, paste, plus it into our document and make sure that it is in words we understand, in a structure we understand. Otherwise, we read it once, we're not going to remember that and we can't use it. It still lives in that other document. It doesn't live in the document that we're creating. So that creation step, that creation process is so vitally important to not only make sure you're internalizing it, but also putting it on a page so we can use it again later.
Are the vast majority of tests open book?
It completely depends. It completely depends on the law school, and it can be all open book, all closed book. It can vary by professor. But even if it's a closed book exam, I get this question from students a lot. Is it still worthwhile creating yet another organizing condensed step, canned answers in our case? And the answer is yes, because the value proposition of canned answers is, again, the internalization of the material and the structure of it. So you still get to see, how would I answer this issue? We're talking about an analysis attack plan and rule statements. How would I answer this issue when it gets triggered on a final exam? We can't bring the content into the final exam with us, but we absolutely can make sure that it's clear, like visually and substantively in our mind. And then if you do have a closed book exam, you actually can do this step one more time. And that can look like what I like to call no look rule rewrites. And what that means is that you take a blank Google Doc or a blank Word doc and you write the rule as if that issue has been triggered so that you can see, okay, how well am I remembering this? Because that's going to mirror what you do on the final exam much more closely than something like creating flashcards or something like whiteboarding. Like, show yourself, go through the actual process of what that's going to be like on game day.
100%. And the science backs that up too. Like if you just have a blank page and just says, hey, okay, don't look at something and then write, literally just write and see what you can recall. And people hate it because there's that moment where you're just sitting there and you don't remember a damn thing, right? And you're like, oh, okay, let me just look. It's like, no, just sit on it and it will start to percolate back, right? And you'll start to remember. And then that's where all those, I think, like literally you're creating connections in your brain that weren't there before. Like, you're forging them.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, the sort of last thing to remember here too is when you have a fact pattern in front of you, the facts in the fact pattern are going to trigger memories of rule statements if you have done the work to recreate them multiple times. Because whether somebody's hiding behind a desk or somebody got locked in a room or somebody fell asleep, like those facts are going to trigger rule statements of things that you've learned. So you're not totally on your own. Your professor is going to be giving you these hints, unintentionally, of course, but they're going to be giving you these hints through these facts that are then going to trigger the internalization work that you've done before.
Awesome. Number five.
Yeah, number five. This is probably my favorite. So number five is Iraq misses the most important part. So when we talk about writing our final exam analysis, everybody's going to hear the acronym IREC, which stands for Issue, Rule, Analysis, Conclusion, which is a really great way to think about, from a very foundational level, how you're going to structure your final exam answer. You're going to state the legal issue that you noticed. You're going to state the rule for that legal issue. You're then going to analyze that legal issue, and then you're going to conclude. The problem is that IREC in and of itself doesn't tell us anything about how we're going to do the A part, the analyze part. And that's 99.9% of our points. That's where all of our points are coming from, which is kind of bizarre to say, because so much of the time that you're going to be spending during the course of the semester is learning these rule statements. And the problem is that that is what they call a necessary but not sufficient part of doing well on a final exam. Knowing the law in and of itself is not going to get you a massive amount of points on the final exam, and in fact is not going to get you a very high grade at all. It's how we use those rule statements. That's how we get points on a final exam. And so we need to know what in the world we're doing when we're talking about the A part, the analysis part, which of course just this basic acronym doesn't tell us. And so the best way that I have found to explain this is when we're talking about analyzing something, you also might hear the A stand for applying. Neither of those are very helpful. I want you guys to think of them as the A standing for arguments, because we want to make arguments. And the way that we make arguments on a final exam is rule statement plus facts equals argument. That's how we get points on a final exam. And so more specifically to the point, the way that I've been thinking about this is the best, most linear, logical way to create these things is that P will argue rule language is met because of facts. D will argue rule language is met because of facts. I call that PWARF and DWARF because it's really easy to remember. And so that's literally how we want to structure our analysis, so that we're making sure that we're identifying the rule statements, using that trigger word because, and then bringing in the facts. Because what tends to happen with all of us 1L year is that we do a thing called making a conclusory analysis. And what that means is that we are saying to the professor, that this rule of law is met because, and then we repeat the rule language. And in that structure, we're not bringing in any facts. And so we're essentially defining our argument or defining our conclusion by just restating rule language. And so, for example, that could look something like, D has a duty to P because D must act like a reasonable person under the same or similar circumstances. And so all that's doing is just repeating the rule language for what duty means. And so if we can get really clear on this very basic framework, we can make sure that we're not falling into these really common traps and that we're giving ourselves a repeatable framework to be able to actually craft these arguments and actually get points on a final exam.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that you have a rule and then you have a particular fact pattern. In other words, you have a instance where someone did something and you have to say, hey, look, these particular facts in this instance, the person hiding under the desk or not divulging what they knew to their client or whatever it is, those particular actions are what put that person either in or outside of that rule, right? Like the rule applies to this person because they did X, Y, and Z. And you're saying that people leave off that second part. They just assert the conclusion, right? They're just like, oh, this person violated that rule or they whatever. And it's like, yeah, but why do you think they violated that rule?
100%. And two important things are happening here. So one of the things that is happening when we think of this analysis framework, if we want to use Poor and Dwarf for a second, is that when people is one, and this is, again, no fault of our own. We're usually not taught this in law school. Final exams are a totally different structure and framework than we're used to. And so no one tells us these things. So if anybody's listening to this, don't feel bad. Don't feel badly. If you've done this, all of us have done this. No one tells us differently. Okay. So with that caveat, yes, what normally will happen is that when students read a fact pattern, usually called an issue spotter, where a lot of people are doing a lot of things, causing a lot of problems, what we tend to do is we will state a rule and say that rule is satisfied because rule language is present. And I think the reason that we don't bring in the facts is because we assume that that's known. So we assume that the professor can see the facts and that it's very obvious that those are the facts that are satisfied. And so it feels very repetitive and it feels very basic to bring in the fact that D owed a duty of care to P because D saw P on the side of the road. D walked up to P and said, can I help you? D then gave P a Band-Aid. D then did not call 911. D walked away. Yeah. Right. But all of those facts, that's how we get the points. Like that's literally how we're getting points for our argument, because we're saying those facts satisfy this rule language. And so there's this tendency to not include the facts because we think they're
or it, only one fact. They don't include enough or something. Yeah,
that can happen. That can happen. That can definitely happen. And then, yes, and more often than not, there's no facts, especially when we start off. And then the other really important thing that's happening there, if you notice, is we're saying P will argue, D will argue. So the other thing that most of us do when we're 1L starting out is that we go into our final exam analysis with a conclusion in mind. And so we go into this right answer mode saying, oh, in the facts, I saw that D violated his duty to P. I'm going to write all the reasons why D violated his duty to P. Sorry, guys, by the way, that's D for defendant, P for plaintiff. Yeah. And so D violated his duty to P. And then we completely blindfold ourselves to all of the arguments that P could or that D could argue that he didn't violate his duty to P. Mm-hmm. And so if we force ourselves to get into that argument, counter-argument mode, we can get so many more points. And professors are looking for that. They're writing the facts ambiguously on purpose so that you can argue each rule, the rule language is met because of these facts and the rule language is not met because of these facts, which is a really difficult skill to get comfortable with because we're not used to writing in a framework of arguments and counterarguments coming into law school.
Yeah. And this is also just getting people ready to be good attorneys, right? Because every good attorney is going to be an expert, not just in their client's point of view, but also obviously their opponent's point of view. It'd be foolish to try to argue with someone and not understand their likely counterarguments.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things that I hear from students a lot is, oh, I read a fact pattern and it was very similar to facts that we learned in a case that we read. And so when I was writing my answer for the practice problem, I said that this case is similar to another case we read, the end. And if that ever happens to anybody, by the way, your professor is never, ever, ever, ever going to write facts that are 100% identical to a case that you read. They are intentionally changing some of the facts with the intention of you arguing why this fact pattern should come out similarly to another one, because all these facts are the same. These are the facts that are the same. And arguably why these facts should come to a different conclusion, because here are all the facts that are different. And so this is an intentional practice when the professor is writing the final exam to open up that opportunity for you to argue both ways. And that's how we move up the curve. That's how we get these really, really juicy points that other people aren't getting.
Excellent. As you were sharing all of this, Angela, Nathan took not quite scrupulous notes, but he took main point notes. Nate, what were you taking these notes for? Did you want to recap everything?
Yeah, I think I've got the 5 points. Reading every line of every case is the worst way you can spend your time in law school, number one. Taking class notes by hand is not a viable strategy in law school when every word matters. Just take transcript style notes instead. Supplements, number three, are not a shortcut. Cheating or being lazy, they are a vitally important part of the process. Number four, outlining, just not enough. You really need to turn those into canned answers and think about the types of questions that you might be asked on the exam that uses all that shit. 5, Iraq misses the most important step, which is basically adding the facts to your knowledge of the rules. You've got to actually use those facts from the fact pattern and not just start spouting off a bunch of rules, but instead say, plaintiff's going to argue this rule because of these facts. Defendant's going to argue that rule because of these other facts.
Heck yes. Nailed
it. I actually took notes. This is like the first time in my life I've successfully taken notes on any presentation.
And handwritten. It worked.
No, this was not handwritten. This was typed.
Yeah.
Oh, it was typed.
He was typing like verbatim what you said too. So, you know, this is going to fit exactly what you said.
I think I got an A on the exam.
Without a doubt.
Great. Well, thanks, Angela, so much for coming on. Is there anything else you want our listeners to know? Any question we didn't ask that we should have?
No, I think those are the big things that I've recognized over the years that are sort of parting ways with some of the traditional advice you'll hear. And so if you guys have any questions about anything we talked about today, feel free to send me a DM on Instagram. It's just at Angela Vorpal.
Okay. And that's the best way for people to get in contact with you. Is there anywhere else they should go?
Yeah, either Instagram or just my website, angelavorpahl.com.
And that's right. Vorpahl, Vorpahl, if you're just listening.
Yeah, that's it.
Thank you, Angela. Really appreciate you coming on the show again.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you guys so much for having me. It's always such a great conversation.
Thanks. All right. We have an ask button here. Do you want to read it?
Yeah, we got a question from the ask button that says, I have a hard time identifying intermediate conclusions. Is there any way I can get help with that?
Huh. So when I hear this question, I think to myself, is this person overly focused on the role of each part of the argument as opposed to the underlying meaning of each phrase within that argument? Because when you do focus on the underlying meaning, yeah, it's not something you're necessarily going to zero in on. Oh, that was an intermediate conclusion. But when you need to figure that out, in the rare cases that you do, it becomes a lot easier to identify which things are acting in support of other things if you understand what each thing is saying.
Yeah, I think that this, like, what I always say is stop thinking about intermediate conclusions. Why are you thinking about intermediate conclusions? Those words, by the way, rarely appear on the LSAT. You know, they will ask you from time to time, they'll ask you about the role played in the argument by something. And then they might describe, you know, one of the answer choices might be something about an intermediate conclusion. But until that happens, I don't think you need to think about intermediate conclusions. Instead, what you should be just doing is ruthlessly looking for and trying to attack conclusions. So most arguments only have one conclusion. They're going to give you a bunch of evidence. They're going to try to make a conclusion from that evidence. You say, wait a second, not so fast. That conclusion is not really justified by your evidence. Boom. That's pretty much it. That's the point of the question. Other arguments, these are rare. What do you think, Ben? 10% of arguments, maybe not even that high. 5% of arguments have two conclusions or more.
Yeah, I don't really know. Anytime, though, that an argument comes to a conclusion, whether it's intermediate or not, right, we're immediately jumping on that conclusion, saying, oh, you just said, hey, so yada yada must be true. And you say, wait a sec, why or why not?
Right. And there are, so I'm attacking every conclusion the second I see it. The second I see that there's a conclusion there, I'm going to be like, whoa, wait a second. I'm not giving you credit for that. I'm going to give you credit for your facts, but I'm not going to give you credit for the conclusions that you're drawing from those facts. So when they start off with like, blah, 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 comma, because, or blah, 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 comma, since, then I go, whoa, okay. So everything you said before the since, everything you said before the because, that's a conclusion.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to look at the evidence that you provide for that conclusion, and I'm going to think about whether the evidence actually proves that conclusion or not. Usually it doesn't. Sometimes it does, rarely, but usually it doesn't. So I'm going to put a pin in that. I'm going to be like, well, wait a second here. They are trying to pull some bullshit right here where they have a conclusion that's not really necessarily justified by their facts. If they do that more than once in the same argument, then now the door is open for it's possible that one of these conclusions was an intermediate conclusion. It's actually probably the case that one of these conclusions is an intermediate conclusion. All that means is they did some reasoning, they reached a conclusion, then they used that conclusion as evidence for some further conclusion. Mm-hmm. That's all that means. All it means is that they're doing argument in steps, where they're saying, because of blah, 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 I think this, and then because of this and this other thing, maybe, therefore I conclude this other thing, this final thing. And they can do it all out of order. It doesn't have to be presented in that linear, you know, start to finish. It could be finish, beginning, middle, or it could be like middle, beginning, finish, or they could order it in a million different ways. But the definition of an intermediate conclusion is simply something that is used as a premise for a conclusion, but that is itself a conclusion based on other evidence that was presented in the passage. I don't know. Can I say it in a simpler way? That made it sound like complicated, but it's really not. It's just, you know, everything in the argument is either a premise or a conclusion. Or sometimes there's some extra just stuff in there.
Opinions of other people, sometimes just plain old background information.
Background, shit that's just irrelevant. But there's going to be, you know, the operative parts of an argument are premise and conclusion. An intermediate conclusion is simply both a premise and a conclusion. That's it. It's a conclusion that they reached based on some evidence. Then they turned around and they reached some other further conclusion using that previous conclusion, that intermediate conclusion, as a premise for the ultimate main conclusion of the argument. That's really all there is to it. I don't know. Maybe I'm still making it sound complicated.
Yeah, I think there is some inherent sense that it's complicated. One thing I was going to add is if you're following anything that Nate is saying, this might help. I hope it doesn't make it worse. But for an argument to have an intermediate conclusion, it has to have at least three ideas, right? Because there's going to be one idea that's acting as a premise and supporting the intermediate conclusion. And then you have the intermediate conclusion, which is the second idea. And then that intermediate conclusion is going to have to turn around and then start supporting the third idea, which would then become the main conclusion. If you only have two ideas, then you can't have an intermediate conclusion because, well, at best, you have a premise and a conclusion, and that's it. And then that just becomes the main conclusion.
Yeah. And that's not to say that every time there's three ideas, one of them is an intermediate conclusion. Far more common is two ideas that are both premises and then a third idea that's a conclusion that you would draw from those premises. Like, for example, if I know that Ben's in Virginia And if I know that Virginia is in the United States, I can combine those two things together to conclude validly that Ben is in the United States.
Yep.
Now, there's no intermediate conclusion there. There's two premises. Ben's in Virginia. Virginia's in the United States. There's one conclusion, which is actually valid here, which is Ben's in the United States. Now, I can turn that into an intermediate conclusion if I provide a further premise, United States is on planet Earth. Then I can use my previous conclusion, Ben's in the United States. That was my conclusion, right? Mm-hmm. And if I combine Ben is in the United States with the United States are on planet Earth, then I now can reach a further conclusion, which is Ben is on planet Earth. Mm-hmm. So in that case, I have three premises, one intermediate conclusion, and one main conclusion. I used two premises to prove that Ben was in the United States. Then I used that plus an additional premise to prove that Ben was on planet Earth. And so the intermediate conclusion, Ben is in the United States, that was both a premise and a conclusion in my argument. It was a conclusion because I had backed it up. I had provided evidence to prove that you were in the United States. It's also a premise of the argument because I'm then turning around and using that to prove some other further thing. So that's really all there is to it. There's just not, but students, like, they love to, I don't know, it's almost like they're reading the arguments looking for intermediate conclusions.
Yeah.
What? No.
Yeah. Especially given the fact that they're not in all of them by any means. Yeah.
It's very rare. So is it evidence? Is it a conclusion? If you see multiple conclusions in the same argument, then you could ask yourself, okay, does one of these conclusions support the other one? Mm-hmm. And in my example, if I knew there were two conclusions, Ben's in the United States, Ben's on planet Earth. Okay, does Ben on planet Earth support the idea that Ben's in the United States? Not really, because there's a lot of other places on planet Earth. Let me think about it the other way around. Does the idea that Ben is in the United States support the idea that Ben is on planet Earth? Yeah, because the United States is on planet Earth. So mm-hmm. Ben in the United States, then I know for sure that that's the intermediate conclusion, not the ultimate conclusion of the argument.
Great.
Two more things on our agenda, Ben. I listened to your episode. It was great. Episode 453. I was on vacation. Ben, you and Eric did an episode. One of the items was someone who left a school. And then when they went back and looked at their transcript some years later, they saw that there was an academic suspension that had been put onto their transcript. You guys were real worried about it and like trying to get this student to get it removed or whatever. And that might still be the correct thing for them to do.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to bring up the possibility. Is it possible that when someone leaves a school and doesn't finish their degree, that's just a thing that happens, is they get like suspension doesn't have to mean you started a food fight in the cafeteria and got suspended from school. Maybe this was put there in a different context, which is just you suspended your education at our school. Like you left our school. Your degree process has been suspended.
Yeah. So I don't know. And I asked your question verbatim to ChatGPT.
Oh.
Not that it will necessarily be the expert, but it does say academic suspension typically isn't routine when people leave a school by choice, such as dropping out or graduating. However, if a student leaves a school due to poor academic performance, then an academic suspension could be involved. Academic suspension is usually a formal consequence for failing to meet specific academic standards set by the institution, such as maintaining a certain GPA.
Okay. And that's very likely to be right. I just wanted to bring that up, that if we have a mysterious suspension appearing on somebody's transcript, that there must be some kind of an explanation for that. Maybe this applicant did leave, though, that school because of poor performance. And maybe mm-hmm. that's why they got the academic suspension placed on their record. I would think that you could pretty easily just write a short addendum to explain, hey, I left this school. I was in good standing when I left, but they put this academic suspension on my record. I don't know what it means. It was 10 years ago. Okay.
Word of the week. This is a word that you put on here, right?
No, Eric did.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. Eric put the word execrable.
Execrable. Okay.
Execrable. E-X-E-C-R-A-B-L-E. Execrable. He found it in Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency by Douglas Adams. I believe that this is probably the same Douglas Adams who wrote Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, would be my guess. But in Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, Eric discovered the word execrable. Do you have any idea what execrable might mean?
Well, I did read ahead and saw that Eric identified this as something. Yeah. And so now I see the word excrete.
Totally. And that's what I always thought, was that it was so similar to excrement. And I've read it in many books myself. I have never looked up a definition of it, but I've always thought that it was like similar to calling somebody shitty.
Mm-hmm.
Like if they did an execrable thing, it's like you're comparing their behavior to that of excrement or excreting.
Yeah.
So I think it must have something to do with that. Should we look it up?
Yeah, let's do it.
You can read the Merriam-Webster definition.
Deserving to be extricated, detestable, very bad, wretched.
I'm going to look up execrated now because it linked to that. Execrated is, to declare to be evil or detestable. It's to denounce or to detest utterly.
Execrate.
I think it has to have something to do with excrement. It just seems too closely related that, you know, that is what we do, right? With excrement, we push it away. We do not like it.
Yeah.
We try to get it as far away from us as possible. So crimes, if you're describing them as execrable or execrable hotel food, they should have done airplane food on that. Execrable. You're basically saying it's like excrement.
So at least in the word execrate, it comes from the word sacred, and X is not. So it's not sacred.
Oh, maybe it's nothing like excrement.
Although I don't think excrement is sacred either. So maybe it's not.
Yeah.
Maybe that's
now
what
I'm
it
thinking
means.
About the word consecrate.
Consecrate. Yeah. To make something sacred.
And so execrate is to make it unsacred. Consecrate is to make it sacred. Huh. Well, you know, long story short, I think I had an incorrect, but nonetheless useful idea of what that word meant, just solely from context, because it's only ever used in really negative contexts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Interesting. Thanks, Eric, for putting that on the agenda.
Yeah, that's great.
And thanks, Angela Vorpahl, for coming on the show. An excellent third appearance on the show.
Yes. Thanks, Angela. Be LSAT famous. Please ask questions or share news with us on our website, thinkinglsat.com, or on socials at LSAT Demon. If you have questions about the LSAT Demon, you can email help@lsatdemon.com. Check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 454 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you. Don't pay for love.